Easter is the day of light. Even when it's cloudy outside, it seems to pour into the sanctuary in a new way. And you all are dressed to match. You look great. But Easter in the Gospel of Luke begins at first dawn. We can imagine the women leaving their homes while it's still night out. It's dark. It takes a while for the light to come into view. They've come to the tomb to prepare funeral spices, to finish the job that was left undone before the Sabbath. They come while it is still dark. What brings you to the tomb on Easter morning? That's what this is. It's the same story every year. Maybe it's told from a different perspective. We follow the disciples to the tomb, expecting to find grief and disappointment, and we are surprised and startled and amazed to see something else. What brings you to the tomb? Is it that sense of amazement or wonder or hope? That need to be renewed? Question pressing on you whether there is some way that God might bring good out of the mess of your life. It could be any of these things, but I'm willing to guess that the real answer might be a tad more mundane. So, how many of you remember being stuffed into some constricted pastel fabric when you were a child? They always saved the most uncomfortable clothes for Easter. It was a metaphor. There was no way you were getting out of that family expectation. And how many of you grew up knowing that Easter was not optional? Whether through family habit or custom or tradition, you piled into the car and you made your way to church. Those are formative experiences, and maybe you still came because someone brought you here, even if that someone is long gone. Their presence is still with you, though, and you wouldn't want to let them down, and it doesn't matter how old you are. And I've mentioned this before and recently. This is why you always feel bad about missing church. And it doesn't matter how long you've been gone or whether you just skipped a week. Those early patterns are hard to break. But they're there for a reason. Because where else can you go when there's nowhere else to go? Where else can you go to be in the midst of people who have suffered and know what that means, to be sick, to grieve, or to have their lives turned around? This is not the place that has all of the answers. It's the place that has the one who has the answers, maybe, but there are also enough helpers who can lend some experience and wisdom, whatever that big thing is that weighs on you. So what brings you to the tomb? For the women on Easter morning, some named later in the story as Joanna, Mary Magdalene, and Mary, the mother of James, it was simply the one thing they could do. So once upon a time, they had been squeezed into those same pastel dresses for whatever religious occasion was on offer. And they were among that community of people, of women who knew exactly what to do when the world falls apart. The Sabbath day had interrupted their burial preparations, and this is how seriously they took their religious observance. Following the death of Jesus, the worst thing they could possibly imagine, they observed their faith. They worshiped and they rested. And the next day, following a sleepless night of tears and prayers, they went to finish the job. What brings them to the tomb on Easter morning? It's the one thing to be done in the face of tragedy, to observe the faith that was handed down to them, even if it maybe didn't seem like it was going to stack up against the tragedy or the need of their own lives, not to mention the world's suffering. Mary and Mary Magdalene and Joanna were simply those people who knew what needed to be done because they had spent enough of their lives around the faithful. They were the sort of people who have casseroles in their freezer waiting for a quick thaw when the time comes when a neighbor is in need. There are just some people like that, some people who know how to go to the tomb and get the job done, and I would argue it's their practice of faith, even when they don't feel like it, that makes them this way. The story doesn't mention how they were feeling, not at first anyway, or what they knew was going to happen next. Their feelings are irrelevant to the story, and their belief is irrelevant too. It's only after the startling news of the angels hear men in dazzling clothes that they remember Jesus' promise, his story of suffering, and what would come next. It didn't matter. They didn't have to remember or believe or see with their own eyes. They came into the presence of God out of something like obligation or force of habit. And let me just say, I know this is not what you expect at church on Easter Sunday. Because there's always a desire to say, Jesus is risen, everything is fixed. And there is some of that in this story. The worst thing we can imagine has been undone. Death has lost its sting, the grave its victory. It's worth remembering how many of us come to the tomb on Easter morning wounded and disappointed, afraid. We would like to think that the resurrection changes everything. Sometimes we just hope it changes something, that God will intervene in our lives and in our world. That meets the reality of medical bills and depression and divorce, and turn on the news and see the war in Ukraine. Hard to celebrate the world being fixed when everything still seems so broken. Some have posited this as an explanation for declining religious practice across all levels of society, church participation, maybe even our church participation. I have to confess, I wonder at the absence of people after a 2-year pandemic. Not for any self-serving reason, I'm paid to be here on Sunday morning. It's easy for me to show up. But I wonder about the world after a 2-year pandemic, confronting our mortality and the world's brokenness. Wonder if that might reawaken our sense of limitations or fallibility, our need for God. There are things that have made it harder to worship on Sunday, whether it's a sense of concern or safety. But I don't think it's, again, that profound. I think sometimes it's easy to get out of the habit. Maybe we wonder what difference belief in God has made when there's so much suffering. The Easter story shows that belief has little to do with it, at least at first. The women are brought into the presence of God because they are practicing their faith. Whether they feel like it, whether they believe it, will make a difference or not. Authors like the historian and sociologist of religion, Diana Butler Bass, have explored this question, analyzing religious demographic data and declining participation in religious communities. And Bass remembers her own experience of coming to faith as a high school student and how she felt like she had to apologize for it. A classmate wondered why she kept a Bible in her locker. It was to catch up with all of the people in her youth group who seemed to know the Bible so well, she said. And the classmate asked her, "Are you one of those religious fanatics?" She replied, "I'm not religious. I've got a relationship with God. I don't really like religion. Religion keeps us away from Jesus. It's more of a spiritual thing." You've probably heard that before. Maybe it makes you nod your head. Maybe it makes you want to tear out your hair. I think we're all susceptible to thinking that words like relationship or experience or emotion lead us to God, even in a Presbyterian church. Sometimes they do. But that can be hard to square with the mundane reality of faith, which has as much to do with someone brought you here as anything else. And the rest, if it comes, may take a while, and sometimes only comes as the grace of God. There's a story I've told before from the Methodist bishop and professor Will Williman, who remembers from student days a time an Orthodox priest came to his divinity school to talk about confessing the faith of the church through the creeds. And after an overlong and sleep-inducing lecture, one student attempted to liven things up, and he raised his hand, and Willimon records the conversation like this: "Father Theodore, what can one do when one finds it impossible to affirm certain tenets of the creed?" And the priest looked at him confused. "Well, you just say it. It's not hard to master. With a little effort, most can learn it by heart." "No, you don't understand," the student responded. "What am I to do when I have difficulty affirming part of the creed, like the virgin birth?" And still looking confused, the priest said, "You just say it. Eventually it will come to you." And then the student had gone from being earnest to being frustrated and pleaded, "How can I with integrity affirm a creed in which I do not believe?" Said the priest, "It's not your creed, young man, it's our creed. Keep saying it, for heaven's sake, eventually it may come to you. For some, it takes longer than others. How old are you, 23? Eventually, it may come to you. Even if it doesn't, don't worry." The pastor and author Eugene Peterson once wrote of an intransigent church visitor who came to worship along with his wife, and he made no bones about it. His attendance was not his choice. He did not believe. He thought it was good for the family to worship together. And then one day, Peterson noticed this usually tight-lipped man began saying the Apostles' Creed. He started with, "I believe in God." And that was it. And then a couple of Sundays passed, and he continued, "I believe in God the Father." A couple of more weeks, "I believe in God the Father Almighty," and it went on like that. Eventually, some months passed, and the man said the whole creed. "Keep saying it, for heaven's sake. Eventually, it may come to you." What brings you to the tomb on Easter morning? It's interesting to observe that for all of the disciples gathered for the events of Holy Week, so few of them chose to bestir themselves to wake up on Sunday morning and check the report of the women who have been to the tomb. They don't believe yet. And the women, observing the proper forms of their faith, became the first evangelists, the first witnesses to the resurrection. Their words seemed like an idle tale, probably says more about the men listening to them than the women telling what they had heard. For whatever reason, the sustaining practice of faith, of religious life, was enough to overcome the women's grief and doubt. And the men, maybe with fewer forms to observe and less to do with the time, during a time of tragedy, you know they're not doing dishes in the upper room as it's still torn apart up there. They don't make it to the tomb, except for one. Peter rushes out, whether out of curiosity or hope. There is enough to draw him into the presence, into the mystery of God, into the first chapter of the rest of his life. The author Marilyn Robinson tells a story of thwarted love in her novel Jack. The titular character, Jack, is a vagrant son of a Presbyterian minister who falls in love with Della, an English teacher in St. Louis. And it doesn't sound too star-crossed at this point, yet the romance happens in the mid-1950s, and Jack is white and Della black. The two have a disastrous first date when Jack flees from underworld lenders to whom he owes money, and Della is stuck with a dinner tab. And they meet by chance in a graveyard where Jack often shelters. Della has come for the scenery and to write a poem, but she lingers too long and is locked in for the night. And as a young black woman in a Jim Crow city, she doesn't have many options, but Jack stays with her, alleviating her fear of the unfamiliar surroundings and the others who use the cemetery for sleep, including Jack. So as it turns out, Della's father is also a pastor, and so the two visit together and reminisce about childhood dinners when the conversation inevitably turned to the Bible, ethics, and the soul. Even from a young age, Jack wondered if his father feared for him, his wayward son. Naturally, then, Jack and Della are unable to meet except in darkness, locked in a kind of place in death. They're at the tomb. They wonder what would have to change for their lives to be different. They think about all the rules that religion has set for them, and they wonder if they might come up with a new set of commandments. Jack says, "We'll still remember the Sabbath, I suppose." Della, it would be pretty hard to forget. I've tried, Jack says. I've made the experiment. No luck? Della asks. I've forgotten one or two, he says, talking about drinking or smoking on the Sabbath. They're hard to forget. She says, no, we'd have to keep the Sabbath. My father couldn't survive without it. I have to object, Miss Miles, Jack says. If we're going to keep honoring fathers and mothers, you know there won't be any new rules. Hypothetically, if this is going to be interesting, she concludes, I guess I don't want to imagine them with the world gone. Seems like tempting fate. What brings you to the tomb on Easter morning? Maybe to do otherwise would be to change too many of the rules, to tempt fate. You do it out of obligation or practice or habit. You do it because someone brought you. And no matter how far you have wandered, the pattern has stuck. You do it out of hope that there is a word for your life here. Or maybe through all the ups and downs of your life, all the disappointments in your life of faith, maybe you do it because you wonder if this time it might be different. Or maybe you do it because you're one of those ones who have been to the tomb and seen with your own eyes the transforming power of God. But Peter got up and ran to the tomb. Stooping and looking in, he saw the linen cloths by themselves. Then he went home, amazed at what had happened. It's worth taking a look for yourself. You may not find exactly what you're looking for. Maybe you will find something better. Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here. He has risen. Keep saying it for heaven's sake. Eventually, it may come to you. For some, it takes longer than others. You keep coming to the tomb for the one time when you're going to return home amazed at what you have seen. Trusting that the Lord will be waiting for you out there just as surely as in here. And if that's not the case for you today, there's always next week. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, Amen.